Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me is editor Simon Lambert. And this week, has the recovery been put on hold? It's likely we'll emerge from recession with growth over this quarter, but are we just going to dive straight back in? Tears, fears, and lockdowns have led Rishi to ramp up his support packages, but again, many of the self-employed feeling left out. How bleak will the winter be, or can we battle our way out of it? Plus, what's all this done to our retirement plans? Simon gives the Chancellor some stamp duty advice. And for something a little bit different, do you actually have to register an appliance for a guarantee? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, after a summer of optimism where we were encouraged that eating out would indeed help out, even after 10 o'clock. Oh, the heady days. Now the country is divided in more ways than one by tears. We had the Chancellor's winter economy statement back in September, but such is the pace of new measures being brought in, Rishi has had to change one of its key planks, the job support scheme, not once, but twice in under a month. So more help for businesses and employees, but there is one group again feeling rather aggrieved, and that is the self-employed. We will get to that issue shortly. But first, Simon, want to ask, is that it for our V-shaped recovery? Is that it indeed for any sort of recovery? Wibbly, V, X, Y, Z.
I think that the V-shaped recovery might be seriously at risk at the moment. The economic performance and the resilience of consumer spending surprised a lot of people over the summer. I think that Britain dug in and did what it did best in times of crisis or otherwise. It went shopping and bought some stuff and went out and splashed the cash. There was money that, you know, was saved. We've talked about the rise of the lockdown saver, some people not having to spend on commutes and things like that. There was the money that probably a lot of money that would have otherwise gone on foreign holidays that was refunded to people. Some people are still waiting on some of those refunds. There was less money spent, you know, on going out. But then there was a real appetite for when you could get back out and actually spend some money, when those heady days of June and July rolled round, people were very eager to do so. And so actually things look pretty rosy. And I think it's safe to say that things look a lot less rosy now. I think it's almost inevitable that Britain will get itself out of recession in the official sense this quarter, because we saw two quarters of negative growth, which takes us up to June. And then we're going to have the July, August, September period, in which I imagine the economy is going to have grown. But then are we going to slide straight back into another quarter or another two quarters of negative growth, the ones that will encompass the final 3 months of this year and the first 3 months of next year? You have to say, looking at the current circumstances, that would look to be quite likely, because what we're seeing is, instead of a loosening, the direction of travel has moved back into a tightening. And with every week that passes, there's a little more tighter stuff on what you can do and what you can spend on. And I think in some places, particularly hospitality, this is having a real effect. For example, in London at the moment, it's on tier two. Walking around this week, other days that I've been in the office in High Street Kensington, it's pretty busy, High Street Kensington. There's quite a few people around. They talk about these pictures of the city being deserted, for example. The city of London is deserted. But the city of London is deserted at the weekend. But the other parts of London, the bits where people live and are less office-based, are pretty busy. But what you don't have now is very many people actually at those pubs, restaurants, cafes, etc., because they can't sit inside with someone who isn't in their own household. So they can sit outside, but how much outside space do most of these places have? They really don't have that much. So the few tables that they've got outside are pretty busy. Most of the tables that they've got inside are empty. We went out for a drink yesterday. One of my team's leaving dues. Will Kirkman is sadly leaving us. And obviously, despite the fact that the six of us have spent all day sat in the office together, we're not allowed to go sit in the pub together. So we had to go find, a pub that had an outside table, which isn't the easiest thing to do because a lot of the outside tables are booked up, but you stand outside that, or sit outside that pub. You're not allowed to stand outside. You sit outside that pub and you look through the window
and it's empty inside, maybe a couple of solitary drinkers or maybe a couple of couples. And we had Sadiq Khan this week, after demanding that London be put into tier two last week, calling for the lifting of the 10 p.m. curfew, because he says it's not needed now, and it would enable restaurants and pubs and bars to do multiple sittings for single household groups. And it's like, yeah, I bet they can hardly wait for that wave of single household groups who are going to be eating and drinking out late into the night and boosting their income. And that's just tier two. So obviously then when you take into account the big chunk of the country that's in tier three, the fact that Wales has gone into a proper lockdown, Scotland's pretty much full on lockdown, you struggle to see how the direction of travel is going to be upward, and it looks like it's going to be more downward. And I think the greatest sign of that has obviously been this yet again another revision of job support scheme that we saw, and a bit more money bunged at everyone by Rishi Sunak.
How many local lockdowns are we going to go into before we get a full national lockdown? Or is it just everywhere else but London, is what some of the arguments are. So going through some of the measures, how bad is this winter going to be? Or has the Chancellor done enough to stave it off, Simon?
Well, the winter plan is looking like it was maybe slightly premature now, isn't it? That was delivered by Rishi in September. We didn't even manage to make it to half term with the winter plan. I think he might be safer just going for a weekly plan from now on.
A bit like quarantine. Well, you know, we'll update you every week and see if anything's changed. And that seems rather sensible once we've had a listen to one group of people. Because the reason he revised it the second time was largely we had this anomaly, didn't we, between tier three and tier two businesses, largely. Obviously, there's discrepancies within those tiers. Whereas if you had shut your business, you would get more money than a company, than a business that didn't have to shut. I mean, you don't get a choice. You have to shut. Therefore, you get government help through the job support scheme. But if you don't have to shut, you get far less support from the government, even though you could have, as you said there, probably zero people coming through your doors and your trade has absolutely fallen off a cliff. So then the Chancellor made the scheme more generous for those companies that have to stay open.
Yeah, and this is a major issue. So obviously the businesses can stay open, the pubs, the restaurants, the gyms, the all those places that have got the issues in tier three can stay open in tier two. But they're severely limited on the business that they can actually do. And some of them are quite rightly saying, either it's almost impossible for us to do meaningful business, or it's just not worth us being open. Yet they're not getting the support in order to make up for that. Whereas if you compare that to lockdown one, when they were all told to shut, they were given grants based on their rateable value. So they were just given some money. And I mean, a conversation with a local pub landlord around here, out in Hertfordshire, you know, he was saying, well, look, I was paid to shut. And that's why I didn't do takeaway pints, for example. But I know another landlord down the road who started doing takeaway pints pretty much immediately. And I know that the amount of money he was paid to shut, he wouldn't have made that much profit in, you know, two months or whatever. So actually, I don't think it's so bad, but that's definitely not the situation that you're getting this time round. The issue is the businesses are getting some help in tier three. Maybe they should be getting more help in tier two. But all of this is really impacting the jobs market. And we've seen this big wave of redundancies. And the government's message all through this flagship thing has been try and keep the businesses afloat while they suffer temporarily from closure. Or then now it's shifted into can we keep them afloat while they can't meaningfully do business? But we've also got the jobs thing. And that was what the furlough scheme was about, was desperately trying to make sure that lots of people weren't made redundant and people were kept in their jobs. Furlough, you know, shifted from that to the coronavirus job support scheme, which then involved the employer making some contribution and some minimum hours. And then it's now shifted into the updated job support scheme. It's all getting really quite confusing, to be honest. But basically, if you look at it, under the furlough scheme, the employer contributed 20%, the government contributed 60%, the reduction in pay for someone was 20%. Under the coronavirus job support scheme, you had to work a minimum of 33% of your hours, the employer contribution was 22%, the government contribution was 22%, so people lost 22% of their pay. So they'd be getting 78%, 33 plus 22 plus 22, 77. But there's some fractions involved in that. So
yeah, it's fine.
To be very clear. Updated job support scheme now, what's happening is the employers are having to put much less in. So someone works their minimum hours of 20%. So they get paid for those minimum hours of 20%. The employer bungs in 4%. So that's down from 22%. The government contributes 49%, and then they have a reduction in pay of 27%. So they're losing more of their pay than they would have done under the original furlough scheme. But they're also losing a bit more of their pay than they would have done under the coronavirus job support scheme. But they're having to work less minimum hours, and their employer is having to put in less. So that means they are more likely to keep their job, because the thing that's most likely to see them lose their job is their employer desperately needing to cut costs. If you're, as an employer, you go, well, I reckon that we can operate at about 20% of our normal business levels, and that means I can pay my staff, I can get my staff to do 20% of their work, and I bung in an extra 4%, then that member of staff manages to stay in their job and only lose 27% of their pay thanks to the government contributing 49%. There's a lot of figures here, I know. I'm sorry for all our listeners. Tier 3 lockdown, there's another scheme where, but this is where, you know, businesses have to shut. Government contributes 67%, the reduction in pay is 33%. You can see why people are losing track of some of this stuff, can't you? The advantage of the furlough scheme was clarity. You know,
you can see the emphasis on this. The emphasis at the start was on viable jobs. So the government wanted to focus that attention, which is why they said a third of working hours. You have to be working. Then Rishi Sunak had to come back to the table and say, actually, we're going to include those businesses that are forced to shut. And then he came back and did, again, those in tier two that are not forced to shut, but have no trade, pretty much. So you can see their intentions, but we are just not in that situation. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. We keep having to do something because we keep having to do something at the other end of shutting places down in order to pursue the strategy that we're pursuing. But once you, and this reflects on the tier system and the messaging and all that other stuff, once you lose the simplicity of just total lockdown, you know, don't do anything, stay at home, and start moving into more nuanced policies, you run into the having to have more nuanced policies to deal with it. Then there's been an argument about whether we should even have this tier system. Should we just, the whole country be put into lockdown? The circuit breaker thing, the things like that. But you look at some areas and they have very, very high levels of cases, and you look at some areas and they don't. And economically speaking, shutting down the entire country, stopping people in North Norfolk or Cornwall or Devon or places like that have very low levels of cases from being able to operate their business, because there are major cities, and pretty much all of the UK's major cities, there are major cities that have high coronavirus levels, not only seems a bit unfair on those people and a bit foolish as a tactic, but is also would also prove even more expensive than the packages that we're having to roll out to all the places that are suffering from the restrictions. So you add all that together, and what I think you have is something that seriously dents business and consumer confidence. So to go back to the is the V-shaped recovery off, I think one of the things lying behind the V-shaped recovery was the hope that this was like, we get it done and then we can try to go back to normal, and people were expected to edge further and further back to normal. And instead, we reached a point and we started edging further and further away from normal.
Yeah.
And so the sort of people are getting more reluctant with their spending, and businesses are getting more reluctant to go, right, okay, we're going to chuck everything. It's recovery time. Let's chuck everything back into it, get our backs into it, because they've done that. And now they're having to shut again. And now people
exactly. You've got to feel sorry for businesses that have forked out thousands of pounds to put up plastic sheets and signs on the floor and all that to make themselves coronavirus secure. And yet even those businesses are being told you have to shut.
Yes. And so we've had a report this morning, the GFK Consumer Confidence Index, which, you know, fears of a looming unemployment crisis weighing on people's minds. It's a survey of 2,000 individuals by market research firm GfK. Consumer confidence overall score deteriorated to minus 31, and that was down from minus 25 in September. Minus indicates the situation is getting worse rather than improving. And Joe Staton, client strategy director at GfK, said, despite low inflation and rock-bottom interest rates, a buoyant housing market, and a raft of government financial stimulus measures, the prospect of rising unemployment is severely depressing our outlook. The index is not yet back to the depths seen in the aftermath of the pandemic, when it dropped to minus 34. But minus 31 isn't very far off minus 34, is it? So, yeah, without wanting to sound like the voice of doom and gloom, I think it's going to be a tough winter, you know. And I think my concern is that we probably will continue spending, but we're going to do that thing where we continue spending and spend a load of money with Amazon. It's like, so I think really the key message to people has got to be that if you are going to go out there and do some spending and do these things, is try to spend in your local businesses. Try to spend in, you know, the businesses that you think they're going to really need my support, and yeah, you know, do what you can. Obviously, you've got to look after your own finances. I'm not saying go completely crazy just to keep the restaurant or pub down the road open, but do try and, you know, spend some money there. Do try and do that, and, you know, maybe if it means it makes your life slightly more complicated than just getting something Amazon Prime to your door, and you maybe end up paying a little bit more for it. Maybe do that anyway, just to try and support that business, because they're going to need it. They're going to really, really, really going to need it.
Yeah, you might be surprised that actually Amazon is not the cheapest in town necessarily for some things. I mean, I interviewed a lovely Lunya, it was called, Spanish restaurant owner in Liverpool, to see how he'd been affected. And he said the thing that's really saved them, I mean, they're already in about £300,000 worth of rent debt, or they will be, is their online offering, their deli. So they've really pivoted towards that. And so after the interview, I thought I would treat myself to a jamón. Why not? A proper one, like a big one. And it was a lot cheaper than in Amazon. Right, but I do want to talk about not just local businesses who must be feeling very worried at the moment, but also self-employed workers. Now, as part of Rishi's latest statement, he did expand the job support scheme, made it more generous. But he also made the self-employed workers scheme, the self-employment income support scheme grant, to give it its proper title, he made that more generous as well. So we had an extension of that. It was 80% that was paid. Then it went down in the second tranche. Now we have two more coming up, but it was supposed to be just 20% of your earnings. Now it's 40%. So, you know, better. Still, some may argue, not fantastic, but experts say that a third of those who work for themselves will still get nothing. Now, Simon, we've spoken about this, you've written about this. Newly self-employed people, company directors, are not eligible for this help. And the fact that there was a £50,000 criteria, which you think was unfair because there was no such limit for the furloughed workers. Why was this never solved? Because the eligibility criteria is exactly the same, because it is just an extension of the old scheme. Furlough was changed to job support scheme, but the self-employment support scheme was extended pretty much in its entirety, except for the amount you get paid. Is that fair, Simon?
It's fair to say that. So yes, there is the not 20% now 40% element, but there's a cap. So the maximum payout increases from £1,875 to £3,750. So it's not a true 40% because it is capped. And that's the key to this comparison with the furlough scheme, because the furlough scheme is also capped at a maximum that you could get. It was that £30,000 a year element. But then there was this £50,000 income cap for the self-employed. Then there was the limited company directors. Now, limited company, people who work through a limited company and employ themselves through a limited company are not technically self-employed. They are technically employed by themselves, by their own company. However, to all intents and purposes, there are a very large number of self-employed people in this country who work like that. And quite a few of them do that because the companies that they do work for tell them that they must be a limited company. It's not always out of choice to dodge tax. Now, there is a lot of controversy over this, people paying themselves in dividends rather than paying themselves the smallest possible income, paying themselves in dividends, not paying national insurance and things like that. And there has been a lot of dodgy stuff going on at the margins. But that is not to say that everybody who works as a limited company director is indulging in the really dodgy stuff at the shenanigans, or even doing it just so that they can try and minimize their tax on dividends and things like that. There are, the minimizing your tax thing is very widespread, but they are to all intents and purposes self-employed. And what's curious is that the scheme makes a moral judgment, whereas the other schemes don't make a moral judgment. All of the support packages that we have had dealt out have not made moral judgments. The bounce back loans, you can't apply for a bounce back loan if you run a gambling company or things like that. There is no moral judgment made. It was we're just going to try and help everyone because that's what we need to do in order to keep the economy afloat. But a moral judgment has been made here. If you are self-employed through a limited company in such a way, you can't benefit from this. Now, obviously, those people could furlough themselves early on. I think they could probably claim some of this job support stuff, which was very complicated for them. But of course, because quite a few of those people have been paying themselves lower wages and through dividends, they end up getting less of their normal income. You've also got the newly self-employed. Freelancers have been majorly hit by this. Freelancers is a major problem in the creative industries, and particularly in some of this stuff like the theatre and the arts and the performing arts and stuff like that, where people actually literally can't do their job at the moment because of the restrictions. But the curio for me has always been the £50,000 limit as well. It's if you have had trading profits of that in the last 3 years. The thing is, if you're a sole trader and you've had trading profits of £50,000, that means you've basically been declaring your income and paying tax on it. So it's really weird because it means that you're actually being penalized for having paid more tax in previous years. So when you've paid your taxes, right? Sole trader, there's none of this paying yourself in dividends stuff with a sole trader and things like that. You've paid your taxes, and then when you really needed the help, the government went, nah, you're not included. Not just you'll get limited by like capped or something. You just get nothing. And I know people in this position who've lost 80% of their income this year and they've got nothing. Now, they're not a particular, the thing is, a lot of the sole trader group on the more than £50,000 kind of thing, they're not a particularly powerful lobby. They don't have a particularly strong voice. They don't tend to be, you know, sort of corralled around a cause kind of thing. And a lot of them just kind of got on with it. Now, some of those people, we got lucky in a way, because some of those people were going to be the plumbers, the electricians, the tradesmen, the carpenters, who've done nicely for themselves, because they've been making profits more than £50,000, but they've been paying quite a bit of tax. And we got lucky because those people were pretty much prevented from doing their job in lockdown and saw their incomes crash. But then everything rebounded much stronger than everybody expected in terms of work for those kind of people. So you've got I know an electrician at the moment, he's like, I haven't had a break. I don't have enough hours in the day. Same thing with people, a lot of trades people I know, they're like, yeah, I'm overrun with work. But nobody expected that to happen. Yeah. We got lucky in that sense. So we got a get out of jail free card in terms of not having helped those people because, okay, they lost a couple of months worth of income, but now a lot of them are rushed off their feet. But there are still huge numbers of people out there who've really been left quite high and dry by this. And it's an absolute mystery to me, and it's never been explained as to why those people never got help. And I think it will forever remain a mystery. I don't think we'll ever find out. And I sadly don't think they're going to get any help.
No. Well, you'd imagine if they were going to, where they've had a fair amount of time to change that. There are things like a bounce back loan, and it is a very generous loan. First year is interest free, and then it's 2.5%, and they increase the time you have to pay it back from 6 to 10 years, but it is still a loan at the end of the day. But we'll leave that to one side, and we'll talk about coronavirus impacting on, well, all our areas of our lives, but retirement is no different. And we're getting research now that many older people are choosing to delay when they retire because of the hardship caused by the pandemic, and also wanting to help out their kids and their grandkids with money and childcare. This is according to Interactive Investor. They say 20% of people expect to carry on working because of the current situation, with a marked increase in working parents dipping into their pensions to help out their kids over the past year. Now, none of this sounds great, but I guess the question with this is, Simon, a lot of people will be thinking, well, I can just carry on working. Will they?
Oh, well, that's definitely a problem at the moment, because it's very often the way that the people who bear the brunt of rises in unemployment are the young, the new to work cohort of people, and the at the end of their careers cohort of people. So those are the people who tend to have their jobs cut. For the younger people, it often tends to be they just can't get a job. The opportunities have gone. I mean, the stories you're hearing of, like, you know, 1,000 people applying to be a shelf stacker and things like that, it reflects that kind of thing. I mean, they're certainly disproportionately represented in the hospitality industry, which is disproportionately represented in the number of job cuts that we're seeing, because it's disproportionately represented in the number of companies that can't do business properly. But older people as well, you know, they get sort of shuffled out the door that bit earlier, or they get their job cut, and then they find it harder to get another job, largely due to age discrimination, which still very much exists within the jobs market, even though it's not actually allowed to exist within the jobs market. But Interactive Investor said last year, more than half of those still at work thought their lifestyle would improve when they retired. This year, that number has halved. I mean, that's quite a sizable drop. 21% of people aged 60 to 65 putting off plans to stop work. 19% of 66 to 71-year-olds who are still employed also intend to hold on to their jobs. But as you say, how many of them are going to be able to hold on to their jobs? And a quarter voice fears that investment losses they'd suffered in the coronavirus pandemic meant they would never be able to retire. I mean, the stock market has bounced off its lows early this year, but it's not fully recovered. It's still down about 20%. If you're only invested in the UK, you shouldn't really only be invested in the UK. You need to be invested all around the world. Obviously, the US stock market has bounced much stronger, but it's not much use telling people that when they've already lost the money. So forgive me for pointing that out with the benefit of hindsight to anybody who has lost that money. And I think if you ask people at a time of bleak economic times and bleak jobs times and bleak investment times how they're feeling about their retirement, they're going to give you a bleak answer. I would hope that when this is run in a year's time, and hopefully we're not still going around in circles with the same problem, that people are a lot more optimistic. And you never know, I think we'll bounce back from this eventually, and people can be a lot more optimistic. So, you know, I don't know really what to say in that situation, but I'm pretty sure it's going to get better.
I'm with you too, of course. I'm exactly the same. However, I guess the difference with retirement is some people don't have that time. So I'm not saying you're going to die or anything. What I'm saying is if you want to retire, you want to retire in the next sort of year or whatever. That's your plan. That was the argument with all the WASPy women, wasn't it? That, you know, you need time to think about your retirement and what you're going to be doing, and, you know, whether those jobs are going to be available or that sort of life. For us young ones, eh, Simon? We've got lots of time with which to ride this out. It's the rules of investing, isn't it?
Yeah, so the advice is, basically, if you're in that position, try not to spend your investments. Try not to cash in your investments when the market is down. You need to try to hold on to your investments and allow them to go back up when the market recovers. You need to look at what you're invested in as well. Obviously, it's, again, hindsight and all that. It's too late to position yourself into those more defensive investments that are going to protect you, because we've already had the fall. But it's still worth looking at what you're invested in and whether it's right for you, whether you're taking the right level of risk. If you want to be a bit more involved, whether you think you're positioning yourself to profit the best from the kind of companies that can recover strongly or profit in the recovery, or the funds that can do that. But the overall advice is that don't spend those investments. That actually, if you've also got a big pile of cash in a savings account, you're better off spending the cash in the savings account, allowing for leaving yourself the rainy day money, than spending the money in the investment account, because the money in the savings account is cash. It's not earning you anything. Trust me, interest rates are not going back to a point where you're going to earn anything meaningful on that for a very long time. But there's every chance that in a year's time, the stock market could be 20% higher than it is now. So that's why you want to avoid spending the money in the investment account, whether that's an investing ISA, whether it's your pension or whatever it is. And that can also include things like, you know, if you're considering, a lot of people now keep their pension invested and then they spend the income, but they might be taking some of it at 25% cash free tax, tax-free cash lump sum. You might want to wait to do that. You might still, some people still take annuities. Again, you might want to wait to do that. You're getting a double whammy on that because your portfolio is down and annuity rates are pretty awful. So you might want to look at spending the cash. And this is the kind of point when, if you are really struggling with this, talking to a financial advisor is going to be the thing that pays off. You're going to look at it and you're going to think, that's really expensive, and that financial advisor is going to charge me a load of money. Mm-hmm. But arguably, they're probably going to get you back much more in benefit that you, than you're going to end up spending with them. And your initial appointment with them should be free anyway. Most advisors will do an initial free fact find. And then at that point, you want to ask them, how are you going to be able to help me? And what is going to justify the money that I'm going to pay you? And how are you going to make sure that I get more value than the money I'm going to pay you? And once you're happy with that, you can then, you know, take the financial advice and they'll help sort things out for you. Yeah. But this is definitely the point where decent financial advice for those who don't feel confident trying to sort this stuff out themselves will come in.
Agreed. So I'm just going to move on, because you've been putting finger to keypad this week and you've been writing about the stamp duty holiday. Now, initially it was introduced by the Chancellor as a measure to stimulate the housing market after lockdown, and it appears the cut may have been, well, rather too successful, can I put it that way? But Simon, you have a solution. But first, explain the stamp duty holiday and the effect that it's been having. I want to say the effects it's been having, but obviously the housing market is so weird, there's going to be lots of different elements to it, but what people think it might have contributed to.
Well, in the summer of staycations, the stamp duty holiday is the ultimate staycation. It's a holiday on your home. Mm-hmm. It's basically saving you money if you move house. Stamp duty has been cut on the amount of a purchase price up to £500,000. So up to £500, you pay zero tax. And if you spend more than £500,000, you pay tax above that at the normal rates. Maximum saving is £15,000. Stamp duty can be very, very expensive for people buying more expensive properties. And some of those people are not what you would necessarily consider rich and buying mansions. They're just people living in expensive parts of the country. It is a very much hated tax. The bill can run into tens of thousands of pounds for people. And people don't like paying it. And it does put them off moving. Rationally speaking, you have a finite amount of money to move home anyway. You have your savings, you have your equity, you have the amount of money you can borrow in a mortgage. So stamp duty shouldn't really make a difference. It should be factored into the total cost of buying. And so you either move or you don't move. But people are not rational actors. Behavioral economics has demonstrated that time and time again. Many, many experiments. And you wouldn't need to conduct too much of an experiment to show that people are actually put off moving by the whole high stamp duty thing. So when you cut stamp duty, people in those expensive homes or who would prospect of buying an expensive home go, "Woo, actually I could save some money." The problem is it's time limited, so people are rushing to do it before the end of March next year. The end of March next year, you would think, is quite a long time away, and that should give you plenty of time. But even in September, I was hearing people going, "Yeah, we need to do it now. We need to get our house under offer and find one now, because otherwise we're just not going to be able to buy in time."
Well, I was reading a press release.
We've had warnings from people saying, "November 1st, you need to be on it.
Final time. You have to do it
by the start of November." And that still gives you 5 months. But actually, things are taking ages at the moment. It's mortgages that are taking ages more than anything else. But everything else is also taking longer. So the home buying process, you are looking 4 or 5 months, is going to be a rush at the end. It's seen a spike in activity, and this is the problem with stamp duty holidays. Now, I'm deeply conflicted on stamp duty holidays. Stamp duty holidays are economically daft in the sense that they do cause an uplift in activity, but then after the end of the holiday, you get a slump in activity. They do drive up prices because people rush to buy before a certain point in time. So the temporary stamp duty cut, not a good thing. Very, very daft, really. And the last thing we want is higher house prices and people overpaying. And it can be a false economy because you try to save money on the tax, but then you end up spending more on the house. The reason why I'm deeply conflicted is because I hate stamp duty. I think it's a terrible tax and it needs cutting to the bone. So any policy that involves cutting stamp duty, I'm like, hooray, oh, it's a holiday. No, just cut it permanently.
Yeah.
Before Gordon Brown started messing around with it and cashing in on the housing market, a policy continued by every chancellor since, it was a flat 1% on the price of a property. And those properties now, the same property that you could buy for £250,000 when Gordon Brown became chancellor, is now £1 million property in many places. So the one, even if the 1% remained, you'd still be paying more tax just because house prices. Cut the whole thing to the bone.
It's a bit like when you go out for a drink and you think, yeah, I'm going to have a great time. And then you forget every time you do this, you're left with a massive hangover. Anyway.
So anyway, I think it's time for Rishi to defend his stamp duty cut. And the best way to defend his stamp duty cut is to stop it being a holiday and to just make it permanent. Then people will not need to rush for the deadline. That might dampen activity in the housing market, but it will stop the accusations that it's pushing up prices. It'll stop people paying too much for a home, and it'll stop people worrying that they're not going to beat the deadline, and we can just get on to life as normal and paying less tax to move home, which is a good thing because more people will then move home.
The next harebrained scheme, once they realise that there is going to be a hangover after this. And then we get another idea and another idea. Anyway, we're going to move on. We're going to even move on from coronavirus-related things, because it's the end of the podcast, and let's end on a slightly different note, an evergreen consumer issue from your reader, and it relates to guarantees. So really, there's no way to beautifully segue that one, was there, Simon? It's just, you know, it's a handbrake turn, totally different subject, end of the podcast type question, which is whenever, and it's relative to me at the moment because I'm moving house, and so I've got, you know, I've got a lot of these issues going on. Whenever I buy a gadget, appliance, or other electrical item, there's a leaflet inside that says something like, register to validate your guarantee or warranty. I was under the impression, not me, I'm reading, by the way, this is from this is Money Reader. I was under the impression that you are automatically entitled to the manufacturer's guarantee from the date of purchase without having to do anything, in which case, all I need is the receipt, no? Should I be following instructions and registering my products, or is it a wheeze to steal my personal data? And the answer is, Simon?
A combination of the two. So basically, under the consumer law, you get certain protections anyway. That mean, you know, you automatically get a year, but then it should also be fit for purpose. So if it breaks within a reasonable amount of time, you should be able to get it fixed or replaced. So you are protected under consumer law. But the person who's selling it to you can offer a longer guarantee. And they can offer that longer guarantee in exchange for you filling in your details and sending it to them. And that will give you an extra level of protection. Now, why are they doing this? Well, probably because they don't expect it to break within that period of time anyway. And also because then they can get your personal details. And then when the guarantee runs out, they can try and sell you and extend. Or when the warranty runs out, they can try and sell you an extended warranty for a fixed price. And this is a nice little money spinner for companies. So nothing comes for free in this world, and your extended guarantee or little bit of extra warranty on your product comes in exchange for you handing over your data and that company being able to market to you. So it's not a complete con, but it is definitely a bit of a con. You are protected anyway, but they can offer you a little bit more protection in exchange for you handing over your details.
Nice. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.